Our guest this week, we're lucky enough to have Brian Curtis, who is editor at large at The Ringer. He writes about media there, and he also podcasts about media. Brian, let's do this like a choose your own adventure. What do you want to talk about first? The NBA Finals, John Clayton out at ESPN, and just the general landscape of the layoffs and their programming strategy, or the unfortunate passing of the legendary Frank DeFord earlier this week?
Wow. I don't remember this Choose Your Own Adventure when I was a kid. Usually it was like being carried off by the ant people or something like that, as opposed to an array of sports media topics. Why don't we do the NBA Finals first?
Okay, so I sent you a couple hours ago, Lee Jenkins wrote a piece on the stratification of the NBA, and anyone with eyes can really observe that the Cavs and Warriors are just heads, shoulders, chests, and waist above the rest of the NBA, and it appears that it's going to be like that at least for the next 2 years, barring really like seismic injury or suspension or something like that. So far, the playoff ratings are up 4%, but regional ratings in the regular season were reportedly down 14%. Do you think that this like Cavs and Warriors oligarchy is good or bad for the next like 5 to 10 years as far as broader interest in the NBA?
Not for the next 5 to 10 years, but I also feel that we won't have 5 to 10 years of this. When you say barring seismic change happening, whether it's an injury or something weird like that, that almost always happens. And we don't, you know, reel off a decade or a half a decade of this kind of dominance. I feel we always worry about this, and then it takes care of itself, basically. There's no, so I wouldn't worry too much about it. I think, and look, I haven't watched a ton of the NBA playoffs, honestly, because it's really boring, and right. I don't care that much. But I'll be there for every minute of the finals, so it's a little bit of a trade-off.
But it is really boring. It's almost like the NBA over the past few years had gradually morphed. It almost feeling like the college basketball, where you really don't need to pay attention to the regular season and you can drift in March or drift in the playoffs. Now we didn't even get 2 rounds of excitement in the playoffs. You don't think that this is a massive problem for them?
Well, it may be a problem, but what are they going to do about it? You going to break up the Cavs?
No, there's nothing they can do about it right now.
I mean, it's always funny to me to talk about this from a ratings perspective or a network perspective, because what's ESPN going to do? What's Turner going to do? I mean, you know, it's they're in a way with ratings of games and finals, things like that, you play the hand you're dealt. And they're not going to cancel the NBA Finals. They're not going to go to Adam Silver and say, hey, can you make sure that we get put a couple of players on Boston so we can at least get a good Eastern Conference Finals? This is just kind of the way it is. And we deal with it. And then in a couple of years, it'll look totally different. We'll all be saying, oh, my God, it was a massively interesting playoffs. But the finals were terrible. It was the equivalent of those Jason Kidd Nets teams playing the Spurs in the finals. And we don't care about that.
That's true, but I just think intellectually that the next 2 years at least are going to be rematches between this, and then it's going to have been 5 in a row. And for the regular season and the rest of the playoffs, I just don't know how people are supposed to get excited for those games when they really don't have any stakes.
Yeah, 5 in a row would really test people's interest level, wouldn't it? I mean, I think sometimes even 2 in a row. Remember the second Spurs Heat series? And I think the ratings were terrible because people were just out, even though it was a Spurs revenge tour a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I think five would be kind of fascinating, because I think people would really be like, oh, man, this again? Especially if, let's say, the Warriors had won four of those or three of those going into the fifth one. I also think, though, that we can always talk ourselves into a new storyline. And if it was, this is LeBron's last chance, LeBron's revenge, will he finally get that one more ring?
Can he get to within one of Jordan?
Being interested in that finals.
I agree with that. Let's switch a little bit to ESPN's coverage of the NBA. When Bill Simmons, who's been your boss for a number of years now, when he was on NBA Countdown, I've heard him gripe before about how after these games, the playoff games, they flip it to SportsCenter instead of like giving the NBA specialist crew real time to digest what just happened after the games. We always talk about inside the NBA as being really special, but I don't think anybody really cares about what they say before the game. It's them having an hour, or really as long as they need afterwards, to go through and break down everything that happened. Why do you think ESPN flips to SportsCenter immediately instead of giving their countdown crew some time to really break things down?
I think the secret of inside the NBA is that it's not actually about breaking down the game. It's just hangout time. You have your TV on. There's probably, we're probably interested in analysis for what, 10 minutes, 20
yeah,
minutes?
Yeah, that's true. But
then we just want to, and then we just want to hang out into the night with those people. And I have never seen another studio show where you can say that on any sport, where you just say, oh, I just want this on as background noise for the next hour. And it doesn't even really matter what the people are saying. It could just be Charles Barkley chewing scenery and Shaq saying something that I'm not even really paying attention to what he's saying. But I just want to have this on for another hour. And I think that's the problem, right? ESPN doesn't want, nothing against their personalities, but they don't want a free-form hour and a half of their people just sitting there talking.
Right.
Because it's just not going to work. Nobody can. The Fox NFL Sunday guys couldn't do that. The game day guys couldn't do that in the same way. So that's what it is. I don't really actually think it's analysis at all. I think it's just it's almost like more like a podcast or sports radio than it is television.
I think if I were them though, I'd have a panel with like Beto, Jalen, Stephen A, and or Wilbon, like either one or both of Wilbon and Stephen A, and try and hope like those two go at each other almost in a way like Barkley and Shaq do.
Yeah, I would watch that. I would be more inclined to watch that. I put it that way. Sure. I think one of the things we don't love about sports television now in this era when we have all these other options is how structured it is. And the more unstructured it is, the more you could have kind of just like a weird spontaneous argument. That's not like, now let us argue these five things in a row. Would be great. And for all the hate Stephen A gets, if you put him in that setting, I would watch that. I would be interested. At least, that's his sport. He's interested. He's interesting on that sometimes, and let him go.
Well, they do have him on these games, but he's not really bouncing off of somebody. They have a SportsCenter anchor teeing him up and him going off, but there's no counterbalance to him.
Sure. I think Bill and I think Joe Klosterman were talking about this in their podcast the other day, but talking about how it's just really hard for these guys to talk about the actual game in an interesting way. And people say, oh, they're just saying things to be outrageous or to make an argument out. Sometimes I think the actually saying the outrageous thing after the game is better.
I agree with that.
What the analysts actually come up with.
Well, yeah, there's no magnetism towards, like, there was a USA Today piece last week about behind the, like, ESPN's NBA coverage, and Michelle Beadle said, we don't embrace debate, we embrace talk. And it's like, I don't know, I kind of wish they would embrace debate a little bit.
Yeah, talk is great until you get talked out of, then you want something interesting. And by the way, if we're breaking down a game instantly, why can't Zach Lowe be on the set doing it? Isn't he going to have insight into what actually happened? It might be a little more interesting, and he could play, and he can, if Zach wants to yell at Stephen A or Michael Wilbon or whatever, I think that I'd love to watch that personally.
You've got to imagine that's on the horizon, right? But they don't vault people into these positions. I would like to see that as well. I just don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I'd love to see him, Zach Lowe versus Wilbon and or Stephen A.
Again, I think it's sort of this tension between a very formal programmed pre and post game show versus kind of the looser format that we're talking about on Turner that has more time for spontaneity and sort of fun stuff to happen.
Do you think Stephen A, though, would be, like, his ego might not be able to, like, let Zach Lowe vehemently disagree with him? That could be a reason that they wouldn't do it.
All the better for us.
Right, that's their problem.
That's what we always say. We want actual tension rather than manufactured tension. And if it's, oh, you know, don't tell me about that, Zach Lowe, then I want to see that. I want that argument to play out on TV.
Zach Lowe, like, brings actual evidence and tape to it and see what I cannot handle and process. I like Stephen A. I think he's fun. It sounds like I'm criticizing him right now. He certainly is, like, very good at his role. If not, he might be a little bit overexposed, as I say, asking for more exposure for him. Let's now do John Clayton. So that one kind of, you can't say it came out of nowhere, because he follows a pattern of where they've been trimming costs, which is older reporters who aren't necessarily as web dynamic, and they aren't going to be like, Clayton's not out there putting out 90 to 180 second sound bites that they can like share all over their distribution tentacles. But it's like, it's people like him and Ed Werder and Andy Katz who have been there so long, and they're like almost furniture at ESPN for us. It's surprised they couldn't figure out a way to reduce their roles, but grandfather them into at least an occasional presence.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if they tried to do that in those cases. And, you know, there's a possibility that they put that out there and those guys weren't interested in that. If they wanted to be full-time, they didn't want to kind of drift into an emeritus role. I think we imagined, and maybe John Arand even reported, that some of the TV people were basically given under-the-table pay cuts. So they weren't on the ledger of laid-off people, but their roles were reduced, and they're kind of, you know, people who've made ESPN money for 20-plus years. I will say one interesting thing about Werder and John Clayton is that part of this is a technology thing, too. We don't really talk about when they were hired in the 90s. If you and I were watching ESPN, we couldn't read out-of-town newspapers. I couldn't know what was going on in Seattle sitting in my home in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So those guys were really important in a way because they could get up there and say, here's the latest news of the Seahawks. Well, back in those days, there was no way to find that out.
Yes.
Here's the latest news from this. And in a way, ESPN has been so successful technologically of bringing all that news to everyone via the web, if not television, that in a way it's harder for those guys to find a niche because they're not pure newsbreakers like Adam Schefter, like you said. They're not pure Twitter people. But so they have to figure out, what are we going to do? You know, standing up in Seattle in front of the Seahawks thing and saying, here's the latest with the team. Most people have read, who are interested in that, have read a version of that on the web before John Clayton stands up. So I think it's not just ESPN's cold-heartedness, but there is part of this that's technologically has made it harder for those guys to survive.
That's true, but they do really place a premium on breaking news. You talked about that in your podcast with Simmons and Jason Gay a couple weeks ago, like why they really coveted bringing Woj in. There's an MMQB piece about Adam Schefter a couple months ago that discussed how there's an actual like scoop scoreboard that Seth Markman keeps about like who gets the breaking news in the NFL, and Adam Schefter's life mission is to just crush all takers. But they've gotten, at the same time that they bring Woj in and they really, 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 really focus on Schefter and the NFL, with college football, they got rid of Brett McMurphy in this round of layoffs. They got rid of Joe Shad about a year ago or so. And now they don't really have any national college football newsbreakers.
Now, it's sort of a very narrow idea of scoops, right? We want NFL transactions. We want NBA transactions, and that's it. You know, Schefter and maybe Mort are going to get into some of the friction within a team. Woj will certainly get into that stuff, but it's very top down. You know, and then maybe if you say like, well, how do we find out other stuff about the NBA? Okay, well, maybe Ramona Shelburne writes a big magazine piece, right?
Uh-huh.
Or maybe Seth Wickersham's recent piece about the Seahawks. That kind of gets into that other stuff. But ESPN on television anyway, it's a very top-down model of scoops, and it's normally one guy.
Yeah.
It's Schefter. It's Woj. And college football is funny because I just don't think it works the same way. I think I love college football, but I think there's probably less interest in a kind of national insider guy than there would be in those other sports.
Well, there's not player movement. There's recruiting, but if you're like really, really into the like nitty gritty of recruiting reporting, it's a little bit of a seedy business, and ESPN really hasn't ever delved into that. And so it just really just becomes coach and AD hiring and firing, and then scandals, which they can report on with outside the lines.
Sure, sure. And if you're into the recruiting stuff, you probably have a subscription somewhere else anyway, and you're getting most of your inside dope there.
For ESPN's new programming package, it's going to be Greeny into Bomani and Pablo, and that's basically really what all the changes are going to be, and those don't start until January 2018. I'm of the belief that however you define success, whether it's metrics, whether it's how proud they are of the content internally, and like pickup, I think that the Bomani and Pablo show is going to succeed, and I'm very skeptical of the Greeny show. How do you feel about those two programs?
That's basically how I feel. I don't know, and this is no criticism of Greeny in particular, but I just don't quite understand yet what the audience for that show is. And maybe it just hasn't been explained to me, maybe it isn't, but you know, my mother-in-law gets up in the morning and watches GMA. Okay, so that she's there. A golf fan is going to get up and watch Morning Drive on Golf Channel. NFL, person who's way into the NFL, my uncles who love pro football will go to NFL Network. I don't know who that fan is in the middle who doesn't want to watch the morning shows, who isn't sports-specific enough to go off to those other cable channels, but wants to go to kind of a general interest sports interview light news program. And maybe it's a failure of imagination, but I just don't quite understand who that would be.
Well, they brought in Bill Wolf, who was the original producer on Around the Horn. He launched the Rachel Maddow show and had a lot of success there. And then he kind of had lack of success with The View and Chelsea Handler. So I think that they're going to go for a real like generalist crowd with that. I don't know what I would program on ESPN from 7 to 10 a.m. if I were them. They've gone through lots of iterations and none of them have really worked since, I don't know, maybe even Patrick and Olbermann in terms of being like must-see television. So what would you do if you were in charge of ESPN? What would you program there?
In the morning?
Yeah.
I think the thing with Greeny is the key is the casting. And it's not just saying we have Mike Greenberg hosting a show. That's not enough for me. I'd say who's his foil? Who is the Mika Brzezinski to his Joe Scarborough? Who is sitting there deflating him, making fun of him a little bit, keeping him in check, being his on-air partner? Who are the other people that he's playing off of on the set? Because it really has to be a great cast, or I just don't think Mike Greenberg talking to a camera, which is more or less what we get on Mike and Mike in the Morning, the telecast version, is going to be enough. I think we don't have enough information yet. I really want to see who the next three or four names are. And it doesn't even have to be an ex-athlete. It doesn't have to be the kind of the original FS1 idea. Oh, let's get Andy Roddick and Donovan McNabb in the studio. Yeah, that'll work. It just has to be some people that are really interesting. And you want to see, like, if Pablo didn't already have a job, Pablo being on that set would be fantastic.
Well, both of those shows, I believe, are going to be run out of New York, so I would imagine that Bomani and Pablo are going to be involved in that show at least occasionally, just because Bomani goes on Mike and Mike all the time. So given that they're going to be recording in the same city, I would believe that they would at least have recurring roles on that show.
That would make sense. But in terms of somebody who could be there every day, who is fully committed to the show, I'd just love to see who that's going to be. But I really think you need those people, because I don't know that Mike is going to be enough of a beacon by himself to get everybody to tune in.
One of the names that got put out there was Jalen. I think that would be interesting.
Sure. That's a good idea. Our old pal.
And then, like, for Bomani and Pablo, the reason I think that it's going to work is because I think they're both very interesting and dynamic people. And I don't know if I'm a general consumer or not, but when I watch sports like television or sports talk programming, I'm hoping that people are going to say things that are profound that I don't think I would have thought of on my own. And I would put them in the category of more likely to do that than Greeny. And then also the show is going to be produced by Eric Rideholm, who created PTI and Highly Questionable. And he presides over Aaron Solomon, who runs Around the Horn. And those shows all are successful in ESPN's afternoon block, more so than anything else that they can put on there.
Yeah, I agree with the profundity thing, that you're going to hear something that you might not hear, that you'll actually remember 5 minutes after the show's over. I think it's interesting that both Pablo and Bomani come from, not from TV. They're guys who, I think it's probably fair to say about both of them, didn't spend their whole life dreaming of being on sports television in a way some other ESPN personalities did. So they come with a little bit of an outsider perspective, maybe a little bit of a skepticism about the whole thing. What can we do on TV that's different from what's already out there?
The show is going to be fun. The one thing that I worry about is I wonder if the MS-ESPN crowd isn't going to give this show a chance because they disapprove of some of the things that Pablo and Mamani say on Twitter.
Maybe. It's in a slot, I think, that it's you don't need a giant primetime full buy-in audience. It's not quite the same, probably. It's not quite, you know, it's not quite like a Scott Van Pelt kind of audience. Right. Where you need absolutely everybody. You can have people that are big fans of those guys. I still really wonder about the whole MS-ESPN thing, whether people are really, you know, whether people are just being annoyed on Twitter or whether they're really tuning out in mass because they're mad at what Bomani's Twitter feed is like. I mean, Pablo's Twitter feed is, you know, he's retweets a few Trump things, but I don't remember him, you know. His Twitter feed seems pretty wild, even if you kind of understand what his political inclinations are.
The I don't know, I could see the MS-ESPN thing hurting ESPN on daytime ratings margins. I don't think that it's driven any of their well-chronicled subscriber losses. It's just the idea that there's somebody out there who cancels his whole Comcast package because he doesn't like Mike and Jamel seems really far-fetched to me. You went to Texas. Like, if Texas is playing on ESPN, that state is going to watch the game, period, end of story. And if your team is playing on there, if you're a sports fan, you need ESPN. And if you're cutting the cord, you're figuring out a way to still have it, whether that's by getting, like, a skinny bundle or by, like, using your parents' password, you're consuming it. Where it does maybe impact ESPN is on the daytime studio margins, but that's maybe ESPN's like eighth biggest problem.
Yes, and the bigger issue there is let's get some good shows on television that people actually want to watch, and then we'll worry about whether Clay Travis's fans are going to follow us to daytime TV or not. I agree with you. I think right now the liberal quote unquote, and I'm making giant air quotes here, the liberal ESPN thing is mostly about it being a thing, you know, in the air that could be dangerous to them at some point in the future, right? Not are we actually liberal, because the evidence for that is pretty scant, but is this something that's going to be used to beat us over the head with like a club for 10 years? I mean, you mentioned I went to the University of Texas. Whenever I get on my Texas message board and somebody mentions ESPN, even in the most boring context, everybody's like, liberal ESPN, liberal ESPN. And I went to school in Austin, by the way.
Yeah,
I'm from liberal Austin, and people still throw that out there. So I just wonder. I mean, this has been used for years against papers like the New York Times, CBS News, and other things like that. And whether that actually has any kind of impact on there is questionable to me. But it's almost sort of interesting as a kind of line of attack to me, more than whether it's real or not, or even whether it has any impact on the ratings.
But I don't know. I think that it's gained such critical mass that it is an issue for them. Like I said, the rights fees and maybe like people like Netflix and Amazon and Apple entering the bidding process for these rights over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years is problematic, and the subscriber losses are problematic. Way below that is the perception of how their studio shows lean. And to make to your point, like with everyone bringing everyone into the tent with SVP, they made a also point to put the old guard SportsCenter anchors in a rotating cast on the show before SVPs, and then there's old guard SportsCenter anchors on the ones after it. So for the people who drift into ESPN for the games and stay there are not going to be in danger of having the being like inundated with liberal bias.
Yeah, I also wonder, by the way, if ESPN just reprogrammed half of its shows. Will Cain became SVP's new co-host on the nightly Sports Center. Whether the people who are shouting about liberal ESPN would actually care. Whether they would change their minds or whether they would just shout about something else. I don't believe that they're actually mad at this. I think this is a lot of this is, you know, less actual political offense and more here is a catchphrase that we can repeat over and over again as a way to destabilize and criticize ESPN and make it toxic in the eyes of certain people.
Let's switch over to Frank DeFord. You and I both had pieces about him this week. I was astonished that he would like pick up the phone for me and talk. As you mentioned yesterday in the podcast with Bill Simmons, he just speaks in perfect paragraphs, and every word he says you can use as a quote, and it's just remarkable. I'm not sure I've ever spoken to anybody else that I could qualify like that. Do you think that there's ever going to be, going forward, a sports writer who can really capture the national like attention of somebody like DeFord or more recently Rick Riley or Bill Simmons? Or is it just too fragmented now that nobody is ever going to have that type of platform again for writing?
It's probably mostly the latter, pretty fragmented, but Wright Thompson comes pretty close, doesn't he?
Not when, to when Simmons writes, or DeFord.
But given our new media world
given the media world that we live in, as you said, he can drop a piece and everyone in our circle who cares about this stuff has to read it and look for what he found and how he found it and how he crafted it. But I don't think it's the same mass name recognizance by any stretch of the imagination of some of these other people.
I think that's right. And I think the thing about DeFord was also the multimedia career he had later.
True.
Really brings him to a new generation of fans. You know, it's not just magazine nerds that care about Frank DeFord. Often when we talk about the long form gods, we are mainly talking about all of us who like to write long form, who are studying them and, oh, how'd he write this? How'd he get that story? Frank DeFord was huge just with the general public. Forget magazine people. He was just a giant star, thanks later to HBO and NPR.
Yeah, some of the people who I just would never expect to know him via NPR. And I don't really listen to NPR, but there are a lot of people who do, and he's been a part of their lives there for like 20 years.
Yeah, and it's people, I think I said this to Bill the other day, but it's people who don't like sports. Or don't very much like sports. And Frank was kind of there in to sports. It was like, I'm never going to read the sports page. I'm never going to watch ESPN. But if Frank DeFord talks about sports for a minute and a half, I'm in. I'm totally locked into this dude.
I agree with that. Let's move on to your personal career. So you came up, you spent some time at Slate, the Daily Beast, the now defunct New York Times Play magazine section. Was your first contact with Bill Simmons when you wrote that piece for Slate about him after the Red Sox won the World Series?
Yeah, his book had just come out, and I wrote a weekly pop culture column for Slate. And my topics were such luminaries as The Lord of the Dance and Larry the Cable Guy. And Bill's Red Sox book came out, and a couple of people at the office said, oh, you should do a column about Bill Simmons. And I remember going to them and saying, well, we all read this guy. I know that. But is it really Bill Simmons? Should I do a column about Bill Simmons? I'm like, yeah, you should do it. And that's how I met Bill. That was back in like 2006, I think.
Was that piece well read, like in the parlance of Slate at the time?
It was because he hadn't had, I can't say that he had zero mainstream national media pieces, but he had very, very few. Will Leach was kind of like chronicling Bill's book tour on Deadspin, if I remember at the time. I remember Deadspin's place in the media universe was very different back then than it is now, where it's right at the center of everything. But like, I think the New York Times profiled him 2 weeks after I did. So it was kind of the first piece for a lot of people. I remember Ross Douthat, now a columnist in the New York Times, wrote about that Simmons column, because there were a lot of us 20-somethings out there that were reading Bill and just hadn't been like, oh, this is a guy. Let's read a story about this guy to that point.
If somebody just like discovered you at Grantland, as I imagine a lot of your Twitter followers may have, what are some pieces that you would like are particularly proud of from Daily Beast or Slate or New York Times that people should go look for and dig up?
Ooh, particularly proud of is a tough word. I don't know if I'm particularly proud of anything, but I wrote, what was fun to do was back in circa 2006, 2007, I wrote a media column for the Times for Play, the now defunct Play magazine, as you say. Don't you love the word now defunct?
I do. I try to use it every chance I get.
This is what, when you and I get to work in media circa the 2010s, now defunct is an adjective we get to use all the time. The now defunct Grantland, the now defunct Play. What other now defunct publications will I get to work
Gawker
on? My career's over. Yeah, there you go. But I wrote a media column for them, which was really fun, and which was, I wrote about Tony Kornheiser when he got Monday Night Football, and I wrote about John Madden. I wrote about, set your clocks back 10 years ago, how cool it was to be a member of a rivals college football message board. I wrote about Marv Albert. I mean, that was in a way the first time I'd gotten to do what I do now at a place with any kind of prominence. And it was really, really fun. I wrote about ESPN.com. I remember saying that ESPN.com was publishing too much. What a 2006 thought that was. Of course, now they publish like 50 times as much as they did back then. But that was, to me, that was really fun. And it was a total test drive for everything I later did at Grayland and now at The Ringer.
When you sit down for like one of these like in-depth profiles on Joe Buck or Sean McDonough or Jim Gray or something like along those lines, where it's not like reactionary, it's something you're really planning out. How, once you've gotten all of your research, how do you like turn off Twitter and just get into a frame of mind to get it started and get working on it?
Ooh, that may be the hardest thing, right? I turn off Twitter and email, and also I have one of those little simple note kind of programs where you have your daily tasks in front of you, and I make sure that the only thing on the task board is write the lead of the story, work on section two, just whatever is possibly in front of me, because otherwise I will just go down whatever rabbit hole I'll go down, so I don't have to do what I'm actually supposed to do.
Do you ever start, like when you can't figure out a lead, do you ever write the body and then come back to it? Because for me, when I write a piece like this, I have to get the beginning or I'm totally worthless.
Now, all the time I do, I just work on other parts of it, usually the ending. Huh. Often I write the end first.
How many drafts do you go through?
Dozens and dozens.
Really?
I don't know. It kind of depends on how you define draft. I mean, if something, are we talking draft like something I submit to my editor? But if it's something I work on at home and, you know, revise, print out, go back, revise again, revise again, revise again. I mean, I wind up with a stack of paper a foot high.
So you print it out for revisions.
Sometimes that helps to read to me, to take it off the computer screen and read it in another medium. But I mean, my editors will tell you that I revise feverishly and all the time, because I'm just terrified that it's not good enough, or I haven't gotten to the place it should be.
How many different editors at The Ringer typically will read a piece before it publishes of yours? Like one of the big ones.
It may differ, but my editor is Sean Fennessy there. So he and I, who is also the editor of The Ringer. So he and I mostly work together, and you know, I'll bring in other people if I need some help or want some fresh eyes on it.
As editor at large, what are your tasks there that are behind the scenes that we don't see?
It's what a ceremonial title that is, isn't it? Editor at large. Back in the old days of Time Inc., they would take out to pasture journalists and make them editor at large. It was kind of like being professor emeritus. So I'm not quite out to pasture yet, I don't think, but it's generally to 90% of my daily existence as being a writer, and I'd say there's a 10% in there, sometimes higher, to talk about the direction of the site, to give advice, to talk to young writers, to talk to anybody who wants to talk about a piece they're working on, to talk to Bill, anything like that, just to be a general sounding board, a voice, if people want to talk about where we're going.
You'd lived in New York for a while before heading out to LA for The Ringer. What are the biggest positives and negatives of LA versus New York? And you're not allowed to say the weather or the traffic.
I can drive to 7-Eleven at 11 o'clock at night, which is very different than the New York experience. So I'm from.
Is that a positive or a negative?
Probably both. If you see my waistline, it's probably a negative. I'm from Texas. And one of the things I realized when I came to California was that I'm kind of a Western guy in orientation. I like driving. I like driving around. I like, you know, I was in New York for a dozen years, so I loved walking down to a bodega and ordering a bodega sandwich at 2 a.m. That was, you know, one of the great pleasures of my life. But out here, I like sunshine. Is that the same thing?
That's the weather.
I like not freezing. I like being in a car. I live fairly close to the ocean, so I like going down to the beach. I don't know. I just like being in the Southwest rather than... I always felt like a visitor in New York, even though I was there for a really long time.
That's interesting. I feel like a lot of people think that way when they live there.
Yeah, and I don't feel that way here at all. I feel like... Not that I'm some, you know, Californian that I've upgraded my car and bought the convertible yet, but I feel like generally feel like a Californian, even though I've been here less than 2 years.
If you could live anywhere in the country and it wouldn't affect your job at all, like where would it be?
I think I would have probably said LA before I moved out here. I still miss Fort Worth, Texas a lot. I think if I had to pick up and move and I could still do what I do now, I'd probably live just about anywhere. I always like to travel and pull up stakes, as my wife would tell you. Mm. And I'm pretty curious about anything. If you told me I was going to do a year in Chicago, I'd say, hey, sounds great. Let's go.
I'll show you all the places that can make your waist even bigger. Oh, go ahead.
I'll take you up on that. That's all I was going to say.
So yesterday the Ringer announced that they've got a new deal with Vox. You said by email before we talked that you don't know much about it beyond what the press release said, which indicated that it's essentially ad sales and CMS, which is the back end of how you publish. It's like taking advantage of their platforms for advertising and publishing. The biggest questions I had, which I guess you don't know the answer to, so I might be speaking to a wall, is whether Vox has any equity stake in The Ringer, like no matter like how small, and whether they are going to help with distribution. Because for a web startup like The Ringer, and I still think it's a startup despite being about a year old now, distribution's really hard, especially with the way that Facebook has changed since the days of Grantland, where Facebook was a lot more friendly to publishers in terms of doling out outbound clicks, and as opposed to wanting everything kept within their platform and wanting to show you more engagement and baby photos. And so it's tougher to draw an audience to a website now than it was in 2014, 2015. So I was wondering if Vox is going to be offering any distribution help.
Well, you're talking to a wall, but you're talking to a particularly friendly wall. I'll say that. So I would actually kick those questions up to the actual editors rather than the editor at large of The Ringer, who can speak to that a little bit better than I can. I will say that what I was so happy about hearing about the deal and reading about the deal is that it has no effect on our editorial apparatus at all, which is really, as I said, 90%+ of my focus. So I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. All of my colleagues, Shea Serrano is going to keep being Shea Serrano, and thank God for that, on the NBA, and Ben Lindbergh and David Shoemaker and all our pals. So really, it doesn't, I think in terms of my life, my daily life at the Ringer, it doesn't affect me at all. I'm really happy, and I can't wait to see how the new site looks.
Is there anyone who's new at the Ringer who wasn't at Grantland that you just foresee as a huge star in this industry?
Kevin O'Connor, NBA writer, has done a fantastic job. And there's so many. Allison Herman, our TV critic, who's impossibly young and is doing a fabulous job writing about television. There's a whole bunch. You know, really, it's the culture side. I think we have lots and lots of new people. And I really encourage people to sort of dive into that because it's a really cool swinging culture section. And like I said, people like Kevin have come in and have been just awesome. And from day one, people like Roger Sherman and Claire McNear, you know, who are well known in web world.
Yeah, Kevin Clark as well, Wall Street Journal, but he's doing really good stuff there.
Oh yeah, I didn't even mention Kevin because Kevin's a superstar beyond all superstars.
What's something that you? How do you think the Ringer's tech coverage is going? Because Grantland covered sports and pop culture, but the Ringer added tech.
Yeah, I think it's really good. We hired this editor, Molly McHugh, who I until recently shared an office with, and I think it's really good. I've been really pleased not only with the quality of it, but how sort of investigative it is and how sort of muckraky it is. I'd have to, you know, I could give you a list of pieces, go back and look, give you a list of pieces, but I've been really interested. It's a new thing for us, but I think it sort of fits nicely with our buffet of sports and culture.
In like October and November, you went on a string of writing a lot of Trump pieces, and you've mostly tailed off of that as of late. Was there a conscious decision that it's like, okay, there's so much Trump stuff everywhere, let's like be an escape and stick to sports, pop culture, and technology?
Probably a little bit, but mostly it's where is Brian's attention focused? Is there an important sports announcer profile I have to write this week, and I have to take my eyes off Trump a little bit? It's funny with Trump because that's probably not something I anticipated writing at all about very much. You know, I covered both conventions last year. I think a lot of us thought this was going to be a pretty boring Hillary versus Jeb presidential election. That it wouldn't be as much a part of our either Twitter feed or media diet as it has turned out to be. But my sort of take on the whole thing is that you can't not write about Trump. And I get criticized on Twitter and elsewhere. I say, oh, do we have to hear about the president again? Yes, you do, actually. Because everything is about the president. I mean, if we're talking about liberal ESPN, that is fueled to some extent by Trump. The gravitational pull of Trump, Colin Kaepernick, all these various players speaking out. This is a thing, and we can't close our ears because we'd rather write about the NBA draft lottery or, in my case, about FS1 and their new morning show. We have to, you know, Trump is.
Wait, are you covering the new morning show?
Well, as an example. That would be something.
That by the same token with Greeny, it's going to be tough. Like, this is nothing against Wright and Carter. And I would say that Horowitz has exceeded my expectations in terms of how many people are watching The Herd and Undisputed right now. So I don't know if I would bet money against him, but I'm interested to see how that works and how we define whether that works.
Yeah, and whether how it works means help Skip as right. much as meanings, you know, has a viable morning show. Because as we've read, this is as much about giving Undisputed, which is in terms of money, in terms of push, in terms of everything their prestige show right now, giving them a lead in, as opposed to actually having a kind of viable morning show. I like Nick Wright, though. I'm interested. I like when he talks, I pay attention. So I'm interested to see how it goes.
It's a little bit off topic, but I think it's going to be fascinating to see if that relationship between Chris Carter and Odell Beckham has some issues with the Giants this year, because it was well chronicled that Beckham skipped OTAs and worked out Johnny Manziel. He also worked out with Chris Carter last week, and Carter and Wright were pretty vocal supporters of his on television, and they're going to be out in New York. So I think that's going to be an interesting dynamic with their access to him this fall.
It gets, and it's great for them, right? I think of Colin Kaepernick calling Shannon Sharpe, what was that, a couple of months ago?
A couple weeks ago,
to insist that he wanted. I mean, to me, in this age where we like, why do we want to watch people debate on TV? If the people actually have access to the biggest stars and can tell us things about those people, then that makes us want to watch.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about in general sports media or The Ringer or you that you think is like vital to discuss right now?
I don't know that there's anything at the top of my mind. No, I think we covered the waterfront, didn't we?
No, I agree. Thank you very much for coming on. It was great to have you. Would love to do it again sometime. And I definitely best of luck with everything going forward.
This was huge fun. Thanks for having me on. Anytime you need me, you know where to find me.
Thanks,
Brian. Give me a couple of hours on Pacific time so I'm actually awake when we talk.
Sounds good, Brian. Thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.